That is impossible, Master. Impossible! They have cut themselves off from their source. This is their way, Master. They are a new cell and have established themselves on Gamu.
But surely we could...
Your pardon, Master. The coordinates of their place in the scattering were contained only in a no-ship's workings and have been erased.
Their tracks are completely covered?
There was dismay in his voice.
Completely, Master.
Disaster. He was forced to rein in his thoughts from a sudden frenzied darting.
They must not learn what we have done here, he muttered.
They will not learn from us, Master.
What talents have they developed? What powers? Quickly!
They are what you would expect from a reverend mother of the Bene Gesserit, but without the melange memories.
You're sure?
There is no hint of it.
As you know, Master, we...
Yes, yes, I know. He waved her to silence.
But the old one was so arrogant, so...
Your pardon, Master, but time presses. These honored maters have perfected the pleasures of sex far beyond that developed by any others. So it's true what our informants said. They went back to the primitive tantric and developed their own ways of sexual stimulation, Master. Through this, they accept the worship of their followers.
Worship.
He breathed the word.
Are they superior to the breeding mistresses of the sisterhood?
The honored maters believe so, Master.
Shall we demon...
No! Waff dropped his elfin mask at this discovery and assumed the expression of a dominant master. The face dancers nodded their heads in submission. A look of glee came over Waff's face. The return to Lilazu of the scattering reported truthfully. By a simple mind print, he had confirmed this new weapon of his people.
What are your orders, Master? The old one asked.
Waff resumed his elfin mask.
We will explore these matters only when we have returned to the Tlilazu Corps at Bandalong. Meanwhile, even a master does not give orders to an honored mater. You are my masters until we are free of prying eyes.
Of course, Master. Shall I now convey your orders to the others outside?
Yes, and these are my orders. This no-ship must never return to Gemu. It must vanish without a trace. No survivors.
It will be done, Master.
Technology, in common with many other activities, tends toward avoidance of risks by investors. Uncertainty is ruled out if possible. Capital investment follows this rule, since people generally prefer the predictable. Few recognize how destructive this can be, how it imposes severe limits on variability, and thus makes whole populations fatally vulnerable to the shocking ways our universe can throw the dice. Assessment of Ix, Bene Gesserit Archives. On the morning after that initial test in the desert, Shiana awoke in the priestly complex to find her bed surrounded by white-robed people. Priests and priestesses.
She's awake, a priestess said.
Fear gripped Shiana. She clutched the bed covers close to her chin while she stared out at those intent faces. Were they going to abandon her in the desert again? She had slept the sleep of exhaustion in the softest bed with the cleanest linen she had experienced in her 8 years. But she knew everything the priests did could have a double meaning. They were not to be trusted.
Did you sleep well?
It was the priestess who had spoken first. She was a gray-haired older woman, her face framed in a white cowl with purple trim. The old eyes were watery but alert, pale blue. The nose was an upturned stub above a narrow mouth and outjutting chin.
Will you speak to us? The woman persisted.
I am Kenya, your night attendant.
Remember?
I helped you into your bed. At least the tone of voice was reassuring.
Shiana sat up and took a better look at these people. They were afraid. A desert child's nose could detect the telltale pheromones. To Shiana, it was a simple, straightforward observation. That smell equals fear. "You thought you would hurt me," she said. "Why did you do that?" The people around her exchanged looks of consternation. Shiana's fear dissipated. She had sensed the new order of things, and yesterday's trial in the desert meant more change. She recalled how subservient the older woman, Kania. She had been almost groveling the previous night. Shiana would learn in time that any person who lived through the decision to die evolved a new emotional balance. Fears were transitory. This new condition was interesting. Kania's voice trembled when she responded. "Truly, child of God, we did not intend harm." Shiana straightened the bed covers on her lap. "My name is Shiana." That was desert politeness. Kania already had produced a name. "Who are these others?" "They will be sent away if you don't want them, Shiana." Kania indicated a florid-faced woman at her left, dressed in a robe similar to her own. "All except Alosa, of course. She is your day attendant." Alosa curtsied at the introduction. Shiana stared up at a face puffy with water fat, heavy features and a nimbus of fluffy blonde hair. Shifting her attention abruptly, Shiana looked at the men in the group. They watched her with heavy-lidded intentness, some with looks of trembling suspicion. The fear smell was strong. "Priests." "Send them away." Shiana waved a hand at the priests. "They are haram." It was the gutter word, the lowest term of all for that which was most evil. The priests recoiled in shock. "Be gone," Kania commanded. There was no mistaking the look of malevolent glee on her face. Kania had not been included among the vile ones, but these priests clearly stood among those labeled as haram. They must have done something hideous for God to send a child priestess to chastise them. Kania could believe it of priests. They had seldom treated her the way she deserved. Like chastened bee-dogs, the priests bowed themselves backward and left Shiana's chamber. Among those who went out into the hallway was a historian locator named Dromind, a dark man with a busy mind that tended to fasten onto ideas like the beak of a carrion bird onto a morsel of meat. When the chamber door closed behind them, Dromind told his trembling companions that the name Shiana was a modern form of the ancient name Siona. "You all know Siona's place in the histories," he said. "She served Shai-Hulud in his transformation from human shape into the divided god." Styros, a wrinkled older priest with dark lips and pale, glistening eyes, looked wonderingly at Dromind.
"That is extremely curious," Styros said. "The oral histories claim that Siona was instrumental in his translation from the one into the many."
"Shiana, do you think..." "Let us not forget the Hadi Banoto translation of God's own holy words," another priest interrupted. "Shai-Hulud referred many times to Siona."
"Not always with favor," Styros reminded them. "Remember her full name, Siona ibn Fuad al-Siefa Atreides."
"Atreides," another priest whispered. "We must study her with care," Dromind said. A young acolyte messenger hurried up the hallway to the group and sought among them until he spied Styros. "Styros," the messenger said, "you must clear this hallway immediately."
"Why?"
It was an indignant voice from the press of the rejected priests. "She is to be moved into the high priest's quarters," the messenger said.
"By whose orders?"
Styros demanded. "High priest Tuwek himself says this," the messenger said.
They have...
listening. He waved a hand vaguely toward the direction from which he had come. All of the group in the hall understood. Rooms could be shaped to send voices from them into other places. There were always listeners.
What have they heard?
Styros demanded. His old voice quavered. She asked if her quarters were the best. They are about to move her, and she must not find any of you out here.
But what are we to do?
Styros asked. Study her, Dromine said. The hall was cleared immediately, and all of them began the process of studying Shiana. The pattern born here would print itself on all of their lives over the subsequent years. The routine that took shape around Shiana produced changes felt in the farthest reaches of the divided god's influence. Two words ignited the change. Study her. How naive she was, the priest thought. How curiously naive. But she could read, and she displayed an intense interest in the holy book she found in Tuwek's quarters. Her quarters now. All was propitiation from the highest to the lowest. Tuwek moved into the quarters of his chief assistant, and the bumping process moved downward. Fabricators waited upon Shiana and measured her. The finest still suit was fashioned for her. She acquired new robes of priestly gold and white with purple trim. People began avoiding historian Locketer Dromind. He took to buttonholing his fellows and expounding the history of the original Siona, as though this said something important about the present bearer of the ancient name. Siona was the mate of the holy Duncan Idaho, Dromind reminded anyone who would listen. Their descendants are everywhere. Indeed. Pardon me for not listening further, but I am really on an urgent errand. At first, Tuwek was more patient with Dromind. The history was interesting, and its lessons obvious.
God has sent us a new Siona, Tuwek said. All should be clear.
Dromind went away and returned with more tidbits from the past. The accounts from Daris Balat take on a new meaning now, Dromind told his high priest. Should we not make further tests and comparisons of this child? Dromind had braced the high priest immediately after breakfast. The remains of Tuek's meal still occupied the serving table on the balcony. Through the open window they could hear stirrings overhead in Shiana's quarters. Tuek put a cautioning finger to his lips and spoke in a hushed voice. The holy child goes of her own choice to the desert. He went to a wall map and pointed to an area southwest of Keene. Apparently, this is an area that interests her, or, I should say, calls her. I am told she makes frequent use of dictionaries, Dromind said. Surely that cannot be a...
She is testing us,
Tuwek said.
Do not be fooled.
But Lord Tuwek, she asks the most childish questions of Kania and Alosa.
Do you question my judgment, Dromind?
Belatedly, Dromind realized he had overstepped the proper bounds. He fell silent, but his expression said many more words were compressed within him. God has sent her to weed out some evil that has crept into the ranks of the anointed, Tuwek said.
Go!
Pray and ask yourself if that evil has lodged itself within you. When Dromind had gone, Tuwek summoned a trusted aide.
Where is the holy child?
She has gone out into the desert, Lord, to commune with her father.
To the southwest?
Yes, Lord. Dromind must be taken far out to the east and left on the sand. Plant several thumpers to make sure he never returns.
Dromind, Lord?
Dromind.
Even after Dromind was translated into the mouth of God, the priests continued to follow his original injunction. They studied Shiana. Shiana also studied. Gradually, so gradually that she could not identify the point of transition. She recognized her great power over those around her. At first it was a game, a continual children's day with adults jumping to obey each childish whim. But it appeared that no whim was too difficult. Did she require a rare fruit for her table? The fruit was served to her on a golden dish. Did she glimpse a child far below on the teeming streets and require that child as a playmate? That child was hustled up to Shiana's temple quarters. When fear and shock passed, the child might even join in some game, which the priests and priestesses observed intently. Innocents skipping about on the rooftop garden, giggling whispers, all were subjected to intense analysis. Shiana found the awe of such children a burden. She seldom called the same child back to her, preferring to learn new things from new playmates. The priests achieved no consensus about the innocence of such encounters. The playmates were put through fearful interrogation until Shiana discovered this and raged at her guardians. Inevitably, word of Shiana spread through Rakkis and off-planet. The sisterhood's reports accumulated. The years passed in a kind of sublimely autocratic routine, feeding Shiana's curiosity. It was a curiosity that appeared to have no limits. None of those among the immediate attendants thought of this as education. Shiana teaching the priests of Rakkis, and they teaching her. The Bene Gesserit, however, observed this aspect of Shiana's life at once, and watched it closely.
"She is in good hands. Leave her there until she is ready for us," Terraza ordered. "Keep a defense force on constant alert, and see that I get regular reports."
Not once did Shiana reveal her true origins, nor what Shaitan had done to her family and neighbors. That was a private thing between Shaitan and herself. She thought of her silence as payment for having been spared. Some things paled for Shiana. She made fewer trips into the desert. Curiosity continued, but it became obvious that an explanation of Shaitan's behavior toward her might not be found on the open sand. And although she knew there were embassies of other powers on Rakkis, the Bene Gesserit spies among her attendants made sure that Shiana did not express too much interest in the sisterhood. Soothing answers to dampen such interest were provided and metered out to Shiana as required. The message from Terraza to her observers on Rakkis was direct and pointed. "The generations of preparation have become the years of refinement. We will move only at the proper moment. There is no longer any doubt that this child is the one." "In my estimation, more misery has been created by reformers than by any other force in human history. Show me someone who says something must be done, and I will show you a head full of vicious intentions that have no other outlet. What we must strive for always is to find the natural flow and go with it." The Reverend Mother Terraza, conversational record, BG file, GSXXMAT9. The overcast sky lifted as the son of Gamu climbed, picking up the scents of grass and surrounding forest extracted and condensed by the morning dampness. Duncan Idaho stood at a forbidden window when hailing the smells. This morning Patrine had told him, "You are 15 years of age. You must consider yourself a young man. You no longer are a child." "Is it my birthday?" They were in Duncan's sleeping chamber where Patrine had just aroused him with a glass of citrus juice. "I do not know your birthday. Do Golas have birthdays?" Patrine remained silent. It was forbidden to speak of Golas with the Gola. "Shuang Yu says you can't answer that question," Duncan said. Patrine spoke with obvious embarrassment. "The Bashar wishes me to tell you that your training class will be delayed this morning,
He wishes you to do the leg and knee exercises until you are called.
I did those yesterday.
I merely convey the Bashar's orders. Patrine took the empty glass and left Duncan alone. Duncan dressed quickly. They would expect him for breakfast in the commissary.
Damn them!
He did not need their breakfast. What was the Bashar doing? Why couldn't he start the classes on time? Leg and knee exercises. That was just make work because Tay gets some other unexpected duty. Angrily, Duncan took a forbidden route to a forbidden window. Let the damned guards be punished. He found the orders coming through the open window evocative, but could not place the memories that lurked at the edges of his awareness. He knew there were memories. Duncan found this frightening but magnetic, like walking along the edge of a cliff, or openly confronting Shuang Yu with his defiance. He had never walked along the edge of a cliff, nor openly confronted Shuang Yu with defiance, but he could imagine such things. Just seeing a film book holophoto of a cliff-edge path was enough to make his stomach tighten. As for Shuang Yu, he often imagined angry disobedience and suffered the same physical reaction. Someone else is in my mind, he thought. Not just in his mind, in his body. He could sense other experiences as though he had just awakened, knowing he had dreamed but unable to recall the dream. This dream stuff called up knowledge that he knew he could not possess. Yet he did possess it. He could name some of the trees he smelled out there, but those names were not in the library's records. This forbidden window was forbidden because it pierced an outer wall of the keep and could be opened. It was often open, as now, for ventilation. The window was reached from his room by climbing over a balcony rail and slipping through a storeroom air shaft. He had learned to do this without the slightest disturbance of rail or storeroom or shaft. Quite early, it had been made clear to him that those trained by the Bene Gesserit could read extremely small signs. He could read some of those signs himself, thanks to the teachings of Teg and Lucilla. Standing well back in the shadows of the upper hallway, Duncan focused on rolling slopes of forest climbing to rocky pinnacles. He found the forest compelling. The pinnacles beyond it possessed a magical quality. It was easy to imagine that no human had ever touched that land. How good it would be to lose himself there, to be only his own person, without worrying that another person dwelled within him, a stranger there. With a sigh, Duncan turned away and returned to his room along his secret route. Only when he was back in the safety of his room did he allow himself to say that he had done it once more. No one would be punished for this venture. Punishments and pain, which hung like an aura around the places forbidden to him, only made Duncan exercise extreme caution when he broke the rules. He did not like to think of the pain Shuang Yu would cause him if she discovered him at a forbidden window. Even the worst pain, though, would not cause him to cry out, he told himself. He had never cried out even at her nastier tricks. He merely stared back at her, hating her, but absorbing her lesson. To him, Shuang Yu's lesson was direct. Refine his ability to move unobserved, unseen, and unheard, leaving no spoor to betray his passage. In his room, Duncan sat on the edge of his cot and contemplated the blank wall in front of him. Once, when he had stared at that wall, an image had formed there. A young woman with light amber hair and sweetly rounded features. She looked out of the wall at him and smiled. Her lips moved without sound. Duncan already had learned lip reading, though, and he read the words clearly.
Duncan, my sweet Duncan.
Was that his mother, he wondered? His real mother? Even Golda's had real mothers somewhere back there. Lost in the time behind the axolotl tanks, there had been a living woman who had bore him and loved him. Yes, loved him, because he was her child. If that face on the wall was his mother, how had her image found its way there? He could not identify the face, but he wanted it to be his mother. The experience frightened him, but fear did not prevent him from wanting to repeat it. Whoever that young woman was, her fleeting presence tantalized him. The stranger within him knew that young woman. He felt sure of this. Sometimes he wanted to be that stranger only for an instant, long enough to gather up all of those hidden memories. But he feared this desire. He would lose his real self, he thought, if the stranger entered his awareness. Would that be like death, he wondered? Duncan had seen death before he was 6. His guards had repelled intruders, and one of the guards was killed. 4 intruders died as well. Duncan had watched the 5 bodies brought into the keep, flaccid muscles, arms dragging. Some essential thing was gone from them. Nothing remained to call up memories, self-memories, or stranger memories. The 5 were taken somewhere deep within the keep. He heard a guard say later that the 4 intruders were loaded with shear. That was his first encounter with the idea of an Ixion probe. An Ixion probe can raid the mind even of a dead person, Giasa explained. Shear is a drug that protects you from the probe. Your cells will be totally dead before the drug effect is gone. Adroit listening told Duncan the 4 intruders were being probed in other ways as well. These other ways were not explained to him, but he suspected this must be something secret to the Bene Gesserit. He thought of it as another hellish trick of the Reverend Mothers. They must animate the dead and extract information from the unwilling flesh. Duncan visualized depersonalized muscles performing at the will of a diabolical observer. The observer was always Shuangyu. Such images filled Duncan's mind despite every effort by his teachers to dispel foolishness invented by the ignorant. His teachers said these wild stories were valuable only to create fear of the Bene Gesserit among the uninitiated. Duncan refused to believe that he was one of the initiated. Looking at a reverend mother, he always thought, I'm not one of them. Lucilla was most persistent lately. Religion is a source of energy, she said. You must recognize this energy. It can be directed for your own purposes. Their purposes, not mine, he thought. He imagined his own purposes and projected his own images of himself triumphant over the sisterhood, especially over Shuangyu. Duncan felt that his imaginative projections were a subterranean reality that worked on him from that place where the stranger dwelled. But he learned to nod and give the appearance that he, too, found such religious credulity amusing. Lucilla recognized the dichotomy in him. She told Shuangyu, He thinks mystical forces are to be feared and, if possible, avoided. As long as he persists in this belief, he cannot learn to use our most essential knowledge. They met for what Shuangyu called a regular assessment session, just the two of them in Shuangyu's study. The time was shortly after their light supper. The sounds of the keep around them were those of transition, night patrols beginning, off-duty personnel enjoying one of their brief, free time periods. Shuangyu's study had not been completely insulated from such things, a deliberate contrivance of the sisterhood's renovators. The trained senses of a reverend mother could detect many things from the sounds around her. Shuangyu felt more and more at a loss in these assessment sessions. It was increasingly obvious that Lucilla could not be won over to those opposing Terraza. Lucilla also was immune to a reverend mother's manipulative subterfuges. Most damnable of all, Lucilla and Teg between them were imparting highly volatile abilities to the Gola, dangerous in the extreme. Added to all of her other problems, Shuangyu nurtured a growing respect for Lucilla. He thinks we use occult powers to practice our arts, Lucilla said. How did he arrive at such a peculiar idea? Shuang Yu felt the disadvantage imposed by this question. Lucilla already knew this had been done to weaken the Gola. Lucilla was saying, "Disobedience is a crime against our sisterhood."
"If he wants our knowledge, he will surely get it from you,"
Shuang Yu said. No matter how dangerous in Shuang Yu's view, this was certainly a truth. "His desire for knowledge is my best lever," Lucilla said. "But we both know that is not enough." There was no reproof in Lucilla's tone, but Shuang Yu felt it nevertheless.
"Damn her, she's trying to win me over," Shuang Yu thought.
Several responses entered Shuang Yu's mind.
"I have not disobeyed my orders."
Pah, disgusting excuse.
"The Gola has been treated according to standard Bene Gesserit training practices."
Inadequate and untrue.
"And this Gola was not a standard object of education. There were depths in him that could only be matched by a potential Reverend Mother, and that was the problem." "I have made mistakes," Shuang Yu said.
There. That was a double-pronged answer that another Reverend Mother could appreciate.
"You made no mistake when you damaged him," Lucilla said. "But I failed to anticipate that another Reverend Mother might expose the flaws in him," Shuang Yu said.
"He wants our powers only to escape us," Lucilla said. "He's thinking, someday I'll know as much as they do, and then I'll run away." When Shuang Yu did not respond, Lucilla said, "That was clever. If he runs, we'll have to hunt him down and destroy him ourselves." Shuang Yu smiled.
"I will not make your mistake," Lucilla said. "I tell you openly what I know you would see anyway. I now understand why Terraza sent an imprinter to one so young."
Shuang Yu's smile vanished.
"What are you doing?"
"I am bonding him to me the way we bond all our acolytes to their teachers. I am treating him with candor and loyalty as one of our own."
"But he's male."
"So the spice agony will be denied him, but nothing else."
"He is, I think, responding." "And when the time comes for the ultimate stage of imprinting?"
Shuang Yu asked.
"Yes, that will be delicate."
"You think it will destroy him?" "That, of course, was your plan."
"Lucilla, the sisterhood is not unanimous in following Terraza's designs for the Scola. Certainly you know this."
It was Shuang Yu's most powerful argument, and the fact that it had been reserved for this moment said much. The fears that they might produce another Kwisatz Haderach were deep-seated, and the dissension in the Bene Gesserit comparably powerful. "He is primitive genetic stock, and not bred to be a Kwisatz Haderach," Lucilla said.
"But the Tlilazu have interfered with his genetic inheritance."
"Yes, at our orders. They have sped up his nerve and muscle responses."
"Is that all they have done?" Shuang Yu asked.
"You've seen the cell studies," Lucilla said.
"If we could do as much as the Tlilazu, we would not need them," Shuang Yu said. "We would have our own axolotl tanks."
"You think they have hidden something from us," Lucilla said.
"They had him completely outside our observation for 9 months."
"I have heard all of these arguments," Lucilla said. Shuang Yu threw up her hands in a gesture of capitulation.
"He's all yours then, Reverend Mother, and the consequences are on your head. But you will not remove me from this post, no matter what you report to Chapter House."
"Remove you? Certainly not. I don't want your faction sending someone unknown to us."
"There is a limit to the insults I will take from you," Shuang Yu said.
"And there's a limit to how much treachery Terraza will accept," Lucilla said.
"If we get another Paul Atreides, or the gods forbid, another tyrant, it will be Terraza's doing," Shuang Yu said. "Tell her I said so."
Lucilla stood.
"You may as well know that Terraza left entirely at my discretion how much melange I feed this Gola.
I have already begun increasing his intake of the spice.
Shuang Yu pounded both fists on her desk.
Damn you all! You will destroy us yet!
Letzli Lazu's secret must be in their sperm. Our tests prove that their sperm does not carry forward in a straight genetic fashion. Gaps occur. Every Tli Lazu we have examined has hidden his inner self from us. They are naturally immune to an Ixian probe. Secrecy at the deepest levels, that is their ultimate armor and their ultimate weapon. Bene Gesserit Analysis, Archives Code BTXX441WOR. On the morning of Shiana's fourth year in Priestly Sanctuary, the reports of their spies brought a gleam of special interest to the Bene Gesserit watchers on Rakis.
She was on the roof, you say? The mother commander of the Rakian Keep asked.
Tamerlane, the commander, had served previously on Gamu, and knew more than most about what the Sisterhood hoped to conjoin here. The spy's report had interrupted Tamerlane's breakfast of sci-fruit confit laced with melange. The messenger stood at ease beside the table while Tamerlane resumed eating as she reread the report.
On the roof, yes, Reverend Mother, the messenger said.
Tamerlane glanced up at the messenger, Kupuna, a Rakian native acolyte being groomed for sensitive local duties. Swallowing a mouthful of her confit, Tamerlane said,
Bring them back. Those were her exact words?
Kupuna nodded curtly. She understood the question. Had Shiana spoken with peremptory command? Tamerlane resumed scanning the report, looking for the sensitive signals. She was glad they had sent Kupuna herself. Tamerlane respected the abilities of this Rakian woman. Kupuna had the soft, round features and fuzzy hair common among much of the Rakian priestly class, but there was no fuzzy brain under that hair.
Shiana was displeased, Kupuna said. The thopter passed nearby the rooftop, and she saw the two manacled prisoners in it quite clearly. She knew they were being taken to death in the desert.
Tamerlane put down the report and smiled.
So she ordered the prisoners brought back to her. I find your choice of words fascinating.
Bring them back? Kupuna asked. That seems a simple enough order. How is it fascinating? Tamerlane admired the directness of the acolyte's interest. Kupuna was not about to pass up a chance at learning how a real Reverend Mother's mind worked.
It was not that part of her performance that interested me, Tamerlane said.
She bent to the report, reading aloud,
You are servants unto Shaitan, not servants unto servants.
Tamerlane looked up at Kupuna.
You saw and heard all of this yourself?
Yes, Reverend Mother.
It was judged important that I report to you personally, should you have other questions. She still calls him Shaitan, Tamerlane said. How that must gall them. Of course, the tyrant himself said it. They will call me Shaitan.
I have seen the reports out of the hoard found at Daris Balat, Kupuna said.
There was no delay in bringing back the two prisoners? Tamerlane asked.
As quickly as a message could be transmitted to the Thopter, Reverend Mother. They were returned within minutes.
So they are watching her and listening all the time.
Good.
Did Shiana give any sign that she knew the two prisoners? Did any message pass between them?
I am sure they were strangers to her, Reverend Mother.
Two ordinary people of the lower orders, rather dirty and poorly clothed. They smelled of the unwashed from the perimeter hovels. Shiana ordered the manacles removed, and then she spoke to this unwashed pair. Her exact words now, what did she say?
You are my people.
Lovely, lovely, Tamerlane said. Shiana then ordered that these two be taken away, bathed, and given new clothes before being released.
tell me in your own words what happened next. She summoned Tuwek, who came with three of his counselor attendants. It was almost an argument.
Memory trance, please, Tamerlane said. Replay the exchange for me.
Rapuna closed her eyes, breathed deeply, and fell into memory trance. Then,
Shiana says, I do not like it when you feed my people to Shaitan.
Counselor Styro says, they are sacrificed to Shai-Hulud. Shiana says, to Shaitan. Shiana stamps her foot in anger.
Tuwek says, enough, Styros. I will not hear more of this dissension.
Shiana says, when will you learn?
Styros starts to speak, but Tuwek silences him with a glare and says, we have learned, holy child.
Shiana says, I want...
Enough, Tamerlane said.
The acolyte opened her eyes and waited silently. Presently, Tamerlane said,
return to your post, Kapuna.
You have done very well indeed.
Thank you, Reverend Mother.
There will be consternation among the priests, Tamerlane said. Shauna's wish is their command because Tuwek believes in her. They will stop using the worms as instruments of punishment.
The two prisoners, Kapuna said.
Yes, very observant of you. The two prisoners will tell what happened to them. The story will be distorted. People will say that Shiana protects them from the priests.
Isn't that exactly what she's doing, Reverend Mother?
Ah, but consider the options open to the priests. They will increase the alternative forms of punishment, whippings and certain deprivations. While fear of Shaitan eases because of Shiana, fear of the priests will increase.
Within 2 months, Tamerlane's reports to Chapter House contained confirmation of her own words.
Short rations, especially short water rations, have become the dominant form of punishment, Tamerlane reported. Wild rumors have penetrated the farthest reaches of Rakkas, and soon will find lodging on many other planets as well.
Tamerlane considered the implications of her report with care. Many eyes would see it, including some not in sympathy with Taraza. Any Reverend Mother would be able to call up an image of what must be happening on Rakkas. Many on Rakkas had seen Shiana's arrival atop a wild worm from the desert. The priestly response of secrecy had been flawed from the beginning. Curiosity unsatisfied tended to create its own answers. Guesses were often more dangerous than facts. Previous reports had told of the children brought to play with Shiana. The much garbled stories of such children were repeated with increasing distortions, and those distortions had been dutifully sent on to Chapter House. The two prisoners returned to the streets in their new finery, only compounded the growing mythology. The sisterhood, artists in mythology, possessed on Rakkas a ready-made energy to be subtly amplified and directed.
We have fed a wish-fulfillment belief into the populace, Tamerlane reported.
She thought of the Bene Gesserit-originated phrases as she reread her latest report.
Shiana is the one we have long awaited.
It was a simple enough statement that its meaning could be spread without unacceptable distortion.
The child of Shai-Hulud comes to chastise the priests.
That one had been a bit more complicated. A few priests died in dark alleys as a result of popular fervency. This had fed a new alertness into the core of priestly encounters with predictable injustices inflicted upon the populace. Tamerlane thought of the priestly delegation that had waited upon Shiana as a result of turmoil among Tuwek's counselors. Seven of them, led by Styros, had intruded upon Shiana's luncheon with a child from the streets. Knowing that this would happen, Tamerlane had been prepared, and a secret recording of the incident had been brought to her, the words audible, every expression visible, the thoughts quite apparent to a Reverend Mother's trained eye.
We were sacrificing to Shai-Hulud, Styros protested.
Tuwek told you not to argue with me about that, Shiana said.
How the priestesses smiled at the discomfiture of Styros and the other priests.
But Shai-Hulud, Styros began.
Shaitan, Shiana corrected him, and her expression was easily read. Did these stupid priests know nothing?
But we have always thought...
You were wrong, Shiana stamped a foot. Styros feigned the need for instruction.
Are we to believe that Shai-Hulud, the divided god, is also Shaitan?
What a complete fool he was, Tamerlane thought. Even a pubescent girl could confound him, as Shiana proceeded to do.
Any child of the streets knows this almost as soon as she can walk, Shiana ranted.
Styros spoke slyly.
How do you know what is in the minds of street children? You are evil to doubt me, Shiana accused.
It was an answer she had learned to use often, knowing it would get back to Tubek and cause trouble. Styros knew this only too well. He waited with downcast eyes while Shiana, speaking with heavy patience, as one telling an old fable to a child, explained to him that either god or devil, or both, could inhabit the worm of the desert. Humans had only to accept this. It was not left to humans to decide such things.
Styros had sent people into the desert for speaking such heresy. His expression, so carefully recorded for Bene Gesserit analysis, said such wild concepts were always springing up from the muck at the bottom of the Rockian heap. But now, he had to contend with Tuek's insistence that Shiana spoke gospel truth.
As she looked at the recording, Tamerlane thought the pot was boiling nicely. This she reported to Chapter House. Doubts flogged Styros. Doubts everywhere except among the populace in their devotion to Shiana. Spies close to Tuek said he was even beginning to doubt the wisdom of his decision to translate the historian locator Dromind.
Was Dromind right to doubt her? Tuek demanded of those around him.
Impossible, the sycophant said.
What else could they say? The high priest could make no mistake in such decisions. God would not allow it.
Shiana clearly confounded him, though. She put the decisions of many previous high priests into a terrible limbo. Reinterpretation was being demanded on all sides.
Styros kept pounding at Tuek. What do we really know about her?
Tamerlane had a full account of the most recent such confrontation. Styros and Tuek alone debating far into the night. Just the two of them, they thought, in Tuek's quarters. Comfortably ensconced in rare blue chair dogs, melange-laced confits close at hand. Tamerlane's holophoto record of the meeting showed a single yellow glow globe drifting on its suspensors close above the pair, the light dimmed to ease the strain on tired eyes.
Perhaps that first time, leaving her in the desert with a thumper, was not a good test, Styros said.
It was a sly statement. Tuek was noted for not having an excessively complicated mind.
Not a good test? Whatever do you mean? God might wish us to perform other tests.
You have seen her yourself, many times in the desert talking to God.
Yes,
Styros almost pounced. Clearly it was the response he wanted.
If she can stand unharmed in the presence of God, perhaps she can teach others how this is accomplished. You know this angers her when we suggest it.
Perhaps we have not approached the problem in quite the right way.
Styros, what if the child is right? We serve the divided God.
I have been thinking long and earnestly upon this.
Why would God divide?
Is this not God's ultimate test? The expression on Styros' face said this was exactly the kind of mental gymnastics his faction feared. He tried to divert the high priest, but Tuek was not to be shifted from a single-track plunge into metaphysics.
The ultimate test, Tuek insisted. To see the good in evil
and the evil in good. Styros's expression could only be described as consternation. Tuwek was God's supreme anointed. No priest was allowed to doubt that. The thing that might now arise if Tuwek went public with such a concept would shake the foundations of priestly authority. Clearly, Styros was asking himself if the time had not come to translate his high priest.
I would never suggest that I might debate such profound ideas with my high priest, Styros said. But perhaps I can offer a proposal that might resolve many doubts.
Propose, then, Tuwek said.
Subtle instruments could be introduced in her clothing. We might listen while she talks to... Do you think God would not know what we did? Such a thought never crossed my mind. I will not order her taken into the desert, Tuwek said. But if it is her own idea to go?
Styros assumed his most ingratiating expression.
She has done this many times,
but not recently. She appears to have lost her need to consult with God.
Could we not offer suggestions to her? Styros asked.
Such as?
Shiana, when will you speak again with your father? Do you not long to stand once more in his presence?
That has more the sound of prodding than suggestion.
I am only proposing that... This holy child is no simpleton. She talks to God, Styros.
God might punish us sorely for such presumption.
Did God not put her here for us to study? Styros asked.
This was too close to the Dromind heresy for Tuwek's liking. He sent a baleful stare at Styros.
What I mean, Styros said, is that surely God means us to learn from her.
Tuwek himself had said this many times, never hearing in his own words a curious echo of Dromind's words.
She is not to be prodded and tested, Tuwek said. Heaven forbid, Styros said. I will be the soul of holy caution, and everything I learn from the holy child will be reported to you immediately.
Tuwek merely nodded. He had his own ways to be sure Styros spoke the truth. The subsequent sly proddings and testings were reported immediately to Chapter House by Tamerlane and her subordinates.
Shiana has a thoughtful look, Tamerlane reported.
Among the Reverend Mothers on Rakkus, and those to whom they reported, this thoughtful look had an obvious interpretation. Shiana's antecedents had been deduced long ago. Styros's intrusions were making the child homesick. Shiana kept a wise silence, but she clearly thought much about her life in a pioneer village. Despite all of the fears and perils, those obviously had been happy times for her. She would remember the laughter, poling the sand for its weather, hunting scorpions in the crannies of the village hovels, smelling out spice fragments in the dunes. From Shiana's repeated trips to the area, the sisterhood had made a reasonably accurate guess as to the location of the lost village and what had happened to it. Shiana often stared at one of Tuwek's old maps on the wall of her quarters. As Tamerlane expected, one morning Shiana stabbed a finger at the place on the wall map where she had gone many times.
Take me there,
Shiana commanded her attendants. A thopter was summoned. While priests listened avidly in a thopter hovering far overhead, Shiana once more confronted her nemesis in the sand. Tamerlane and her advisers tuned into the priestly circuits, observed just as avidly. Nothing even remotely suggesting a village remained on the dune-swept waste where Shiana ordered herself deposited. She used a thumper this time, however. Another of Styros' sly suggestions, accompanied by careful instructions on use of the ancient means to summon the divided god. A worm came. Tamerlane watched on her own relay projector, thinking the worm only a middling monster. Its length she estimated at about 50 meters. Shiana stood only 3 meters in front of the gaping mouth. the huffing of the worm's interior fires was clearly audible to the observers. "Will you tell me why you did it?" Shiana demanded. She did not flinch from the worm's hot breath. Sand crackled beneath the monster, but she gave no sign that she heard. "Answer me," Shiana commanded. No voice came from the worm, but Shiana appeared to be listening, her head cocked to one side. "Then go back where you came from," Shiana said. She waved the worm away. Obediently, the worm backed off and returned beneath the sands. For days, while the sisterhood spied upon them with glee, the priests debated that sparse encounter. Shiana could not be questioned, lest she learn that she had been overheard. As before, she refused to discuss anything about her visits to the desert. Styros continued his sly prodding. The result was precisely what the sisterhood expected. Without any warning, Shiana would awaken some days and say, "Today I will go into the desert." Sometimes she used a thumper. Sometimes she danced her summons. Far out on the sands, beyond the sight of Keen or any other inhabited place, the worms came to her. Shiana, alone in front of a worm, talked to it while others listened. Tamerlane found the accumulated recordings fascinating as they passed through her hands on their way to Chapter House. "I should hate you." What a turmoil that caused among the priests. Tuwek wanted an open debate. Should all of us hate the divided god at the same time we love him? Styros barely shut off this suggestion with the argument that God's wishes had not been made clear. Shiana asked one of her gigantic visitors, "Will you let me ride you again?" When she approached, the worm retreated and would not let her mount. On another occasion, she asked, "Must I stay with the priests?" This particular worm proved to be the target of many questions, and among them, "Where do people go when you eat them? Why are people false to me? Should I punish the bad priests?" Tamerlane laughed at that final question, thinking of the turmoil it would cause among Tuwek's people. Her spies duly reported the dismay of the priests. "How does he answer her?" Tuwek asked. "Has anyone heard God respond?" "Perhaps he speaks directly into her soul," a counselor ventured. "That's it!" Tuwek leaped at this offering. "We must ask her what God tells her to do." Shiana refused to be drawn into such discussions. "She has a pretty fair assessment of her powers," Tamerlane reported. "She's not going into the desert very much now, despite Styros' proddings. As we might expect, the attraction has waned. Fear and elation will carry her just so far before paling. She has, however, learned an effective command. Go away." The sisterhood marked this as an important development. When even the divided god obeyed, no priest or priestess was about to question her authority to issue such a command. "The priests are building towers in the desert," Tamerlane reported. "They want more secure places from which to observe Shiana when she does go out there." The sisterhood had anticipated this development, and had even done some of its own prodding to speed up the projects. Each tower had its own wind trap, its own maintenance staff, its own water barrier, gardens, and other elements of civilization. Each was a small community spreading the established area of Rakkas farther and farther into the domain of the worms. Pioneer villages no longer were necessary, and Shiana got the credit for this development. "She is our priestess," the populace said. Tuwek and his counselors spun on the point of a pin. Shaitan and Shai-Hulud in one body. Styros lived in daily fear that Tuwek would announce the fact. Styros' advisors finally rejected the suggestion that Tuwek be translated. Another suggestion that Priestess Shiana have a fatal accident was greeted with horror by all, even Styros finding it too great a venture.
Even if we remove this thorn, God may visit us with an even more terrible intrusion, he said. And he warned, The oldest books say that a little child shall lead us. Styros was only the most recent among those who looked upon Shiana as something not quite mortal. It was observable that those around her, Kenya included, had come to love Shiana. She was so ingenious, so bright and responsive. Many observed that this growing affection for Shiana extended even to Tuek. For the people touched by this power, the sisterhood had an immediate recognition. The Bene Gesserit knew a label for this ancient effect, expanding worship. Tamerlane reported profound changes moving through Rakkis as people everywhere on the planet began praying to Shiana instead of to Shaitan or even to Shai-Hulud. They see that Shiana intercedes for the weakest people, Tamerlane reported. It is a familiar pattern. All goes as ordered. When do you send the Gola? The outer surface of a balloon is always larger than the center of the damn thing. That's the whole point of the scattering. Bene Gesserit responds to an Ixion suggestion that new investigative probes be sent out among the Lost Ones. One of the Sisterhood's swifter lighters took Miles Teg up to the Guild transport circling Gamu. He did not like leaving the keep at this moment, but the priorities were obvious. He also had a gut reaction about this venture. In his 3 centuries of experience, Teg had learned to trust his gut reactions. Matters were not going well on Gamu. Every patrol, every report of remote sensors, the accounts of Patrine's spies in the cities, everything fueled Teg's disquiet. Mentat fashion, Teg felt the movement of forces around the keep and within it. His Gola charge was threatened. The order for him to report aboard the Guild transport prepared for violence, however, came from Taraza herself with an unmistakable crypto-identifier on it. On the lighter taking him upward, Teg set himself for battle. Those preparations he could make had been made. Lucilla was warned. He felt confident about Lucilla. Shuang Yu was another matter. He fully intended to discuss with Taraza a few essential changes in the Gamu keep. First, though, he had another battle to win. Teg had not the slightest doubt that he was entering combat. As his lighter moved into dock, Teg looked out a port and saw the gigantic Ixion symbol within the Guild cartouche on the transport's dark side. This was a ship the Guild had converted to Ixion mechanism, substituting machines for the traditional navigator. There would be Ixion technicians aboard to service the equipment. A genuine Guild navigator would be there, too. The Guild had never quite learned to trust a machine, even while they paraded these converted transports as a message to Tlilazu and Rakkians. You see, we do not absolutely require your melange. This was the announcement contained in that giant symbol of Ix on the spaceship's side. Teg felt the slight lurch of the docking grapples and took a deep, quieting breath. He felt as he always did just before battle, empty of all false dreams. This was a failure. The talking had failed, and now came the contest of blood. Unless he could prevail in some other way. Combat these days was seldom a massive thing, but death was there nonetheless. That represented a more permanent kind of failure. If we cannot adjust our differences peacefully, we are less than human. An attendant with the unmistakable signs of Ix in his speech guided Teg to the room where Taraza waited. All along the corridors and in the pneumatubes carrying him to Taraza, Teg looked for signs to confirm the secret warning in the Mother Superior's message. All seemed serene and ordinary, the attendant properly deferential toward the Bashar. I was a Tyre commander at Andiyu, the attendant said, naming one of the almost battles where Teg had prevailed. They came to an ordinary oval hatch in the wall of an ordinary corridor.
the hatch opened and Teg entered a white-walled room of comfortable dimensions. Sling chairs, low side tables, glow globes tuned to yellow. The hatch slid into its seals behind him with a solid thump, leaving his guide behind him in the corridor. A Bene Gesserit acolyte parted the gossamer hangings that concealed a passage on Teg's right. She nodded to him. He had been seen. Terraza would be notified. Teg suppressed a trembling in his calf muscles. Violence? He had not misinterpreted Terraza's secret warning. Were his preparations adequate? There was a black sling chair at his left, a long table in front of it, and another chair at the end of the table. Teg went to this side of the room and waited with his back to the wall. The brown dust of Gamu still clung to his boot toes, he noted. Peculiar smell in the room. He sniffed. Share. Had Terraza and her people armed themselves against an Ixion probe? Teg had taken his usual share capsule before embarking on the lighter. Too much knowledge in his head that might be useful to an enemy. The fact that Terraza left the smell of share around her quarters had another implication. It was a statement to some observer whose presence she could not prevent. Terraza entered through the gossamer hangings. She appeared tired, he thought. He found this remarkable because the sisters were capable of concealing fatigue until almost ready to drop. Was she actually low in energy? Or was this another gesture for hidden observers? Pausing just into the room, Terraza studied Teg. The Bashar appeared much older than when she had last seen him, Terraza thought. Duty on Gamu was having its effect, but she found this reassuring. Teg was doing his job. "Your quick response is appreciated, Miles," she said. Appreciated? Their agreed word for, "We are being watched secretly by a dangerous foe." Teg nodded while his gaze went to the hangings where Terraza had entered. Terraza smiled and moved farther into the room. No signs of the melange cycle in Teg, she observed. Teg's advanced years always raised the suspicion that he might resort to the leavening effect of the spice. Nothing about him revealed even the faintest hint of the melange addiction that even the strongest sometimes turned to when they felt their end approaching. Teg wore his old uniform jacket of Supreme Bashar, but without the gold starbursts at shoulder and collar. This was a signal she recognized. He said, "Remember how I earned this in your service? I have not failed you this time, either." The eyes that studied her were level. No hint of judgment escaped them. His entire appearance spoke of quiet within, everything at variance with what she knew must be occurring in him at this moment. He awaited her signal. "Our Gola must be awakened at the first opportunity," she said. She waved a hand to silence him as he started to respond. "I have seen Lucilla's reports, and I know he is too young. But we are required to act." She spoke for the Watchers, he realized. Were her words to be believed? "I now give you the order to awaken him," she said, and she flexed her left wrist in the confirmation gesture of their secret language. It was true. Teg glanced at the hangings that concealed the passage where Terraza had entered. Who was it listening there? He put his Mentat talents to the problem. There were missing pieces, but that did not stop him. A Mentat could work without certain pieces if he had enough to create a pattern. Sometimes the sketchiest outline was enough. It supplied the hidden shape, and then he could fit the missing pieces to complete a whole. Mentat seldom had all the data they might desire, but he was trained to sense patterns, to recognize systems and wholeness. Teg reminded himself now that he also had been trained in the ultimate military sense. You trained a recruit to train a weapon, to aim the weapon correctly. Terraza was aiming him. His assessment of the situation had been confirmed. "Desperate attempts will be made to kill or capture our Gola
before you can awaken him," she said. He recognized her tone, the coldly analytic offering of data to a Mentat. She saw that he was in Mentat mode then. The Mentat pattern search rolled through his mind. First, there was the Sisterhood's design for the Gola, largely unknown to him, but ranging somehow around the presence of a young female on Rakkas, who, so they said, could command worms. Idaho Golas, charming persona, and with something else that made the tyrant and the Tlilazu repeat him countless times. Duncan's by the shipload. What service did this Gola provide that the tyrant had not let him remain among the dead? And the Tlilazu. They had decanted Duncan Idaho Golas from their axolotl tanks for millennia, even after the death of the tyrant. The Tlilazu had sold this Gola to the Sisterhood 12 times, and the Sisterhood had paid in the hardest currency, melange from their own precious stores. Why did the Tlilazu accept in payment something they produced so copiously? Obvious, to deplete the Sisterhood supplies. A special form of greed there. The Tlilazu were buying supremacy. A power game. Teg focused on the quietly waiting Mother Superior. The Tlilazu have been killing our Golas to control our timing, he said. Terraza nodded but did not speak. So there was more. Once again he fell into Mentat mode. The Bene Gesserit were a valuable market for the Tlilazu melange. Not the only source, because there was always the trickle from Rakkas, but valuable. Yes, very valuable. It was not reasonable that the Tlilazu would alienate a valuable market unless they had a more valuable market standing ready. Who else had an interest in Bene Gesserit activities? The Ixians, without a doubt. But Ixians were not a good market for melange. The Ixian presence on this ship spoke of their independence. Since Ixians and fish speakers made common cause, the fish speakers could be set aside from this pattern quest. What great power or assemblage of powers in this universe possessed... Teg froze that thought as though he had applied the dive brakes in a thopter, letting his mind float free while he sorted other considerations.